Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that falls between the idea and the reality, the motion and the act. It's quite nice here. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
And I'm squeezing all of the orange juice out of Mavis from Coronation Street. Hi, I'm Colin.
Well, here at FDE, we love nothing more than a huge opening. And so here we are in Southwark at Lazarus Laboratories with a canapé in one hand and a glass of champagne in the other. Mark Gatiss is about to change what it means to be human. So let's take a look at the outcome of the Lazarus experiment. This, I think, is one that tends to sort of fall between the cracks in Series 3. It's sort of wedged between the highly beloved Dalek two-parter and the highly beloved human two-parter. What do you think of this one, Colin?
I think it's good, but it's not outstanding in any way. I think it's got three elements to it that together save it.
Ooh.
I think there's kind of the main storyline of Lazarus being the lecherous sort of old man and sort of the leisure hive in reverse for about 10 minutes. And then you've got the Boris Saxon, I'm sorry, Harold Saxon foreboding coming on, which I love. I loved all that season three build up to the reveal. And I think the other part is the Martha family relationship coming to life. All those three elements together carry the whole 45 minutes. I think the challenge I have with it is the monsterness is a little bit too much. It seems to go on forever. But, you know, I think the standout piece actually is Mark Gatiss. He's very, very good in this. So I like it.
I think he's really good, isn't he? The old man acting that he does at the beginning is spectacular.
It's sensational.
And the prosthetics, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Part of the reason why he was chosen for the part, Russell had wanted to cast him as something since the series started, but didn't want it to just be a cameo role. He really wanted to give Mark a good dramatic role to sink his teeth into. And part of the reason he got this role was, in fact, his work on League of Gentlemen, because they knew he'd be able to handle the prosthetics and act through them. And the old man face makeup was literally recreated every day. There was a new prosthetic every day. So as well as having a new face every day and it being modelled on a bust of Mark Gatiss, they also used a bust they have of Vincent Price to add in realistic wrinkles.
Brilliant.
And it is fantastic aging makeup. We get a lot of aging makeup this season.
Yes, I think we've said before it's the BBC foam machine of Series 3.
I missed press on beards.
The funny thing is what I got watching Mark Gatiss again in this, especially the scene where he's up on the roof with Tish, is I feel like I'm watching evil Peter Davison.
Like that's what Mark Gatiss says, isn't it? He's just like when he comes out of the machine, it's like, oh my God, look, I've turned into Peter Davison.
Mm. Well, he had played Peter Davison in League of Gentlemen, hadn't he? That lovely vet who inadvertently kills all of the... he's definitely doing a Peter Davison voice for that, I think.
And it's the same wig. Right. It is literally the same wig.
Mr. Chinnery, isn't it?
yeah.
Mr. Chinnery
it's
wig.
Mr. Chinnery's wig when he's the young man. That is canon. That is confirmed. Yeah, he is the standout for me in this episode as well. And I do agree it falls short. I think part of the problem is I call this episode The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Fly. Because it's basically Jekyll and Hyde with a bit of the fly thrown in.
I guess so.
Yeah, that's good.
Which is fine if we didn't already have a tribute to James Whale's Frankenstein over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I guess so. I have to say that the fact that like the monster stuff is sort of massively thin. I mean, you know, we discover the monster's sort of eating people and then we have a bit of a chase around and we sort of try and blow him up and stuff like that. Like, I am absolutely on board with that because it does give more time for those other two elements to breathe. And I think that Lazarus is an interesting character and the sort of character that you might expect Gatiss to play. I mean, the idea that he's old enough to have memories of the Blitz, that we're in Southwark, not very far from Southwark Cathedral, which is where he hid, you know, he remembers experiencing the Blitz. And just all of that kind of talk about mortality and stuff, like it's not particularly deep or anything, but it does give him the chance to act and it gives him the chance to kind of earn our sympathy in some ways.
As you say, he does it very, very well. And I think the sort of moral of the story, it comes across very well. I think the whole kind of comparing himself to the doctor and what does the doctor know about living forever? And he's like, oh, believe me, it isn't that awesome. And also I think Mark Gatiss describes his character a little bit as sort of, you know, not a victim or anything, but sort of, deluded or misguided, not necessarily evil, but he is pretty horrific to people, every single person, especially the ones he drains. You know, it is this kind of, when you look at it now, it's especially creepy with Tish, with Lady Thor, with everyone. It's just this horrible, creepy, imagine if men could do this, you know, or if people could do this, what the hell would society be like? And I think it reminds me a bit of the last season of Torchwood, which I still can't be bothered to watch again, but that it's the reverse of that, in the sense of what if they'd made this a bit longer, in terms of what Russell normally does, you know, with big epic episodes, is you kind of see the society, how it develops as a result of this technology, and then you press the reset switch or something. But imagine a world where if they had taken it to an extreme and made everyone younger, and what would be happening? You know, it's like his tropes on this stuff that he's done in years and years as well, where he takes technology and takes it to the extreme and sort of predicts the future. But I feel that they could have done a bit of that. They could have had more of that, more of the machine churning out more people, and what would it be like? But you get a good glimpse into it, into him and his sort of horrible nature, and what would it be like if people could the age, and especially horrible men like this.
I mean, is it a thing that actually happens? So we're told, I think, that the technology is in fact really only going to be available to the rich. And the idea that you have rich people kind of feeding on less fortunate people in order to sustain themselves, it's a fairly kind of obvious metaphor, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
But also at the same time, with technology, as we've seen with iPhones and smartphones, when they first came out, they were, you know, the status symbol of the rich. And now, most people have some kind of smartphone or tablet. You know, it may not be every member of the family has one, but the technology becomes cheaper. And I think if Russell had looked forward with that, as you're suggesting, Colin, we could have looked into, you know, the rich people, they go in once, they come out, it's done. But for the poorer people, there's a model where they have to keep going back once a year. And that could be the sting in the tail of the story of, no, they don't. They don't have to. It's just that is how the machine's set up. You know, Van Staten 2 years ago, why sell one cure when I can sell 1,000 palliatives? Mm. But, yeah, that's not the story that Stephen Greenhorn and Russell want to tell. They want to tell the story about a scorpion monster draining people at a cocktail party.
So what do we think of the scorpion monster?
I was just going to ask. I think the body's all right, but the face is just wrong.
Why doesn't it have Mark Gatiss's face? Wouldn't that have been so great?
The funny thing is, it's got a face which isn't Mark Gatiss.
It's the price face.
It's madness.
Obviously, that's what they mean
to do.
They should
have put Peter Davison's face on it.
Coming out of the Starfield, yeah. Look, when I rewatched this week, the first time you really get a good look at the monster when it's chasing the Doctor down the corridor and goes up on the roof and things, I thought, this is really impressive. And the thing it reminded me of was the Scorpion King in The Mummy Returns, which was about 5 years before this and looks dreadful,
yeah,
for a feature film. And to get something that looks better than that, aside from the face, and that's the thing, the face doesn't look bad to me. It just doesn't look like who it's meant to look like.
It should absolutely look like Mark Gatiss.
It's Edmund Warwick.
That's it. But like the whole thing of it being like made out of, you know, a rib cage and stuff like that, like he's sort of exploded and turned inside out. Mm. And the sort of noises that it makes, because all of the transformation really is seen off screen, or you see it happening in shadows on the wall or whatever. But it's all accompanied by these sort of gross popping noises as if, you know, he's kind of bursting open and turning inside out. But, you know, that scene you were talking about where he is running down the corridor, and it does the trick that they do in the Krillitane thing in School Reunion, where it's as if the camera didn't know that it was going to do that. So the camera move kind of lags a bit behind, you know, the thing crawling up the walls and onto the roof. And I think that works really well. And I think it's a surprisingly frightening monster for Doctor Who. Like it, you know, it's gross in the way that the alien's gross, you know?
Yeah. It's a bit like, that Next Generation episode, I think you know the one I mean, Genesis, where they all start to de-evolve into like spiders and scorpions and whatever. But my question is, why did someone not just karate chop it like the Murker? Because why does the Doctor run into a room where there are like umpteen Bunsen burners he can just switch on and just basically show all children how to blow up their school?
I was actually a little bit worried about that scene as a school teacher.
Did you show it in Doctor Who Club?
No, no, but that is exactly what I was thinking of.
You know who should have karate chopped the monster? Olive Woman.
Yes,
and
Olive Woman.
That's actually how she's credited, Olive Woman.
No, that's her name. Yeah, her first name's Olive. Olive Woman. Mrs. Woman.
So much for nominative determinism. But yeah, I mean, in the Radio Times, she's credited as party guest because obviously they didn't want to spoil the joke because that joke is not in the script.
Oh, really? The Olive joke?
It was figured out during filming, and I don't know who suggested it. But yeah, in the script, the line is, "The only risk here is you causing panic," which is just like... Oh, what? Sorry. So obviously someone saw the opportunity for a joke and decided, hey, you know, let's put in a joke.
You do know that she's going to be killed the moment she opens her mouth. But, you know, like they're not just paying her to do one line, are they? She has to do some being killed acting there as well.
Don't kill me, Mr. Ghostface. I want to be in the sequel. Another one of my disappointments in that evacuation scene is, you know, when they come down to the doors and they can't get out and Martha figures out there must be some override in security. First of all, Freema's jump across the reception desk is very leisurely. Very leisurely. But also the camera then goes into the booth and it starts on this desk with a big red button in the middle. But Martha then runs over to the wall and waves the sonic screwdriver. It should be the big red button.
Sure, she hasn't been in Doctor Who long enough to know about the big red button, I think.
That's the in-joke. I mean, to have a machine like that and then it just has to have a massive red button. Like, and then it just, there's all these like, it looks like servers or sound mixing machines or something they're pressing random buttons on. But they need that big red button, didn't they? But what do you guys think of the Doctor meeting Martha's family?
This is my favourite thing about the episode, I think. And we've talked before about, you know, just kind of wondering how Doctor Who can even go on now that Camille Kadjuri's not in it. And, and you know, in previous years, we had sort of seen the family basically sort of every three episodes or whatever. We'd seen them sort of fairly frequently, and we haven't. It's been a while. In fact, we'll go back and talk about this later, but this is her first time back after her kind of one trip, which kind of spirals out of control. So we must make sure that we talk about what we think about that. But I loved Francine in the first episode. I thought she was really terrific. And it was, you know, what's Russell going to do? He can't give us another sort of wonderful, lovable mother. And so he gives us a rather sort of spiky and prickly one who is much, much more confident than Jackie and a bit more difficult than Jackie. And I adore her. I think she's really terrific. Yeah. And, you know, giving her that relationship with her ex-husband and all of that sort of stuff, I think just makes her so much more interesting. And having her so central to this episode, like having a Doctor Who adventure where it's not, you know, Martha's in peril, but it's Martha's family as well. So we've got Francine and she's been invited. She's brought Leo with her and Leo's very sweet.
He's great. I mean, I really enjoy Reggie Yates and his star was sort of on the rise here. You know, he'd been on telly for a few years already at this point, but after this, he starts presenting documentaries and music shows and what have you, which will present a problem for this season later down the line. But here, we're told, even before he arrives, that him in a suit is not something that happens very often. And something I was keeping an eye out for, because, dear listener, as you can probably trace the date we recorded this before we get to the credits, because Nathan and I were at a wedding last night of contributor to the podcast, Simon Moore. Mm. And there it was a black tie function, so people were in bow ties. And, you know, I know how to tie a bow tie, so I was looking around at all the people wearing fake bow ties. And the Doctor is wearing a proper tie bow tie, but Leo, of course, who is not comfortable in a suit, is wearing a pre-tied bow tie. Right. It's just a little character detail.
Yeah.
And also we get a subtle line from Leo, much like Martha's line a few weeks ago in the Shakespeare Code of, you know, what do I do? I'm not exactly white. Leo seems to imply that people might mistake him for a waiter.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he's wearing a tux as well.
Everyone's wearing tuxes and most of the other guests are white.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's just a little line, but I think it's a very true thought for someone who is not in the position of going to these sort of parties, not in the position of wearing a tux and is kind of a bit uncomfortable with that. Mm. I just find Reggie Yates utterly charming and, of course, utterly gorgeous. The episode subverts expectations a little with him because, of course, when all hell breaks loose, he's the one who's incapacitated.
Yeah.
So Tish has to join in the action and Francine, as we've said, is very strong. And I do wonder with Francine, she immediately distrusts the Doctor. Immediately.
Oh, he spilled her champagne. Come on.
Oh, but even before that, like,
I know.
You know, but yeah, true. I mean, rude. But I'm watching it and she has a few other lines here and there. And I get the impression that it's kind of a thing of, because of what Clive has done to her, she's very protective of the men her daughters are getting involved with. She doesn't want them to go through what she's gone through.
And the Doctor is utterly intimidated by her.
Absolutely
intimidated, like cannot cope at all. There's that wonderful thing where he says that he's heard so much about her from Martha, and then he completely dries up.
It's almost like it's basically implied that they've just had a one-night stand and she's trying to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, and it's that comedy of errors thing where the Doctor wouldn't pick up that that's what she thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's an interesting contrast to when he meets Jackie after he brings Rose home and he tries to be as honest as he can. He's like, I employed Rose as my traveling companion, you know, and he's trying to kind of smooth it over. Like his first words to Jackie are basically, sorry.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a year. Sorry. And I kind of watched this scene and when the Doctor dries, he's kind of like, no. The last time I said something, I got hit.
Yeah, well.
And I just love that, you know, what he's trying to switch on the charm that he knows he has in this incarnation. And she's just, no, I am immune, sir.
Yeah, that's wonderful, immune. Isn't it?
I like the way it's so different. I like the way the whole Aliens of London, where it is that 1 year gap, was such a brilliant, brilliant move. I'm so glad they did. Not just not doing it again, but almost subverting it and doing the opposite of it's only been a few hours. And where Martha's like, oh my God, Mom, I haven't seen you for ages. She's like, what? Okay. You know, nice to see you as well.
Yeah.
No, I love Martha's family. I think they should have been in the season for much longer.
certainly we will get a lot more of Francine later in the year and one little brief look at Leo, unfortunately. But, you know, Francine is terrific in it, and it is established here just how protective she is of Martha, and whether that's because Clive was so horrible or whether that's what she's like or whether there's a giant skeleton scorpion thing running around and she's sort of naturally protective as a result of that. Who knows? But she is really good, and Russell just uses her again and again and again.
Yes, like, yeah. And the great thing about Ojoa Ando for we genre fans is she has gone on to play Colonel Casey in the new Thunderbirds Are Go TV series.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She, oh, my goodness.
She's basically the Brigadier in Thunderbirds.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, she's really great. Which I suppose brings us to Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
MBE or CBE.
Yeah, she's huge, isn't she?
She is.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the first thing that I think of is San Junipero.
Of course.
Which, if we had Picks of the Week, it would be that. It's the Black Mirror episode that doesn't make you hate humanity. And, you know, and she's wonderful in it, like just incredibly good in it.
I was lucky enough to see her as Ophelia.
Oh, wow.
Opposite Jude Law as Hamlet.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Penelope Wilton as Gertrude.
Gosh.
Kevin McNally as the uncle. Like, it was a full-blown Doctor Who kind of thing. I mean, that show is the show that made me realize, first of all, Jude Law can actually act, because I hadn't rated him that highly, but I think I'd just seen him in a bunch of similar parts. But she was just amazing as Ophelia. And at the other end of the spectrum, she's also done a film called The Cloverfield Paradox.
Was that terrible?
Well, it's a sequel to the excellent movie Cloverfield.
Yeah.
And it's excellent, excellent follow-up 10 Cloverfield Lane. And it started life as a completely unrelated sci-fi show, which was then folded into the Cloverfield universe, very quietly taken off cinema releases, and was then dropped on Netflix with no pre-publicity. Yeah, it's terrible.
Right.
But but again, she's amazing in it.
I think I've seen that Hamlet.
you think you saw that Hamlet?
I think I've seen it. I remember Jude Law, and they did this amazing snowing indoors effect, but I don't remember much else about it.
At the Wyndham Theatre?
Yeah. Well, I have seen it, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe we were sick together.
Yeah, it was while I was living in the UK. A friend of mine was the set designer, so he got me tickets for the whole season, which was lovely of him.
That was an amazing set. Absolutely amazing design. Yeah, no, she is terrific in it. Again, someone I wish we could have coming back, doing more, because she's, you know, her and Martha together would have been great companions, and you know, a sister-sister relationship.
I entirely agree. I remember at the time in 2007, I thought that's where we were going with this. I thought that the back half of the season would be Martha and Tish bouncing around in the TARDIS.
We do get her back for quite a bit in the last two episodes.
Oh, absolutely, which is wonderful.
She is really great. Mm. And having the two of them together, having her be the one who kind of needs rescuing a little bit as well. Mm. And she's got one hell of a career, doesn't she? Originally, I had thought that, you know, this whole season takes place in a week, that like Election Day. Is Election Day only a few days after?
Yeah, I think it's like 3 days after this.
Can it possibly be? And she's got another job now with Harold Saxon.
Well, I think the implication is because Saxon is funding Lazarus.
Yeah.
So the job she has with Lazarus is the same job she's on her way to in Smith and Jones, because that's yesterday.
Right, right.
And then after that dries up, the company she's working for is owned by Mr. Saxon. So she just gets called into 10 Downing Street. And
right.
The thing is, if you get magically called into 10 Downing Street, you're just going to go, okay.
And I suppose Mr. Saxon knows who she is.
That's why she's got this job.
That's why she's got these jobs. But it is it's an incredible career trajectory, isn't it?
I would love to go into 10 Downing Street around this time with some custard pies and a few harsh words at the moment.
Yeah.
I absolutely love the when you see, when, you know, the end of Utopia, when all this stuff is revealed, spoiler alert, that it all made sense. And there was all this build up ever since the Azor Beloff reading the Telegraph.
Mm.
And it all brilliantly built up. And I went through this thought. I was thinking yesterday, would it have been good to see a bit of Harold Saxon before the reveal? And I think on balance, no, I think they got it right. I think I would have kind of liked, well, him to appear on TV and to have made some statements. And then maybe there is. I haven't seen it, rewatched the rest of the season, but I think they got it right. This distant power sort of that knows the Doctor and is trying to manipulate and discredit him, I think is very, very clever. And then it's just bang at the end of the season.
Are there Vote Saxon posters around yet? When do they first start appearing?
There were Vote Saxon posters in Smith and Jones. But I believe the first Vote Saxon poster is in Captain Jack Harkness at the end of Torchwood season 1.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, just before Jack and Tosh go back in time in the alleyway.
Right.
There's a poster in the background. Yes, I'm pretty sure it was that, because that was around the end of 2006. And then in March 2007, when Smith and Jones comes on, people go, hold on, what's that poster in the back?
Right.
That poster, hold on, didn't Mr. Saxon order the tank to fire on the wet?
Mm.
We found the Ark.
Yes, and it's a really brilliant Ark. You know, it's pretty similar to Bad Wolf in that it's something that happens at the end of the season that has an effect on everything previously. But that was all kind of a bit hand-wavy and sort of a little bit made up as it goes along. Whereas this is at the end of episode 11, the Master travels back in time to sometime during season 2.
Yeah.
And then becomes, you know, a political figure, and then eventually the Prime Minister. It's amazingly simple, but it's super effective.
Yeah. And as you were saying, Colin, I was wondering myself at the end when Francine makes her final call to Martha and says, this comes from Mr. Saxon, you're not safe, et cetera, et cetera. I thought, oh, you know, we could have seen him. But then I thought, well, hold on, if we see John Sim now, when we see John Sim at the end of Utopia, we know he's Mr. Saxon before the Doctor does.
Yeah.
And before he knows he's Mr. Saxon.
Yeah.
Which means the pre-titles cliffhanger of The Sound of Drums isn't a reveal. It's a, so what?
Yeah.
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 But yes, I have a feeling next week in 42, when Martha calls her mum, that's election day.
Yes, it is.
So I think we're the day before election day. Elections happen on the weekend in the UK, don't they, Colin?
No, they happen on Thursdays, and then you kind of get the results coming in on Friday, and by Saturday, you know.
Okay. That's what I'm misremembering then from my time living there. So, yeah, I suppose we're on a Wednesday then. This is a Wednesday night.
It's an eventful week.
It's an eventful week.
and Francine's meeting lots of new people. So she meets is he called Sinister Man?
Sinister Man.
Creepy Man?
Yeah.
Is that his name as well?
Like Mysterious Olive Woman?
Olive Woman and Sinister Man.
My name is Man, Mr. M Man.
Oh, God. Here comes the next big finish set. Olive Woman and Sinister Man.
What does he whisper to, what do you think he whispers to Francine?
I wonder if it's this man was involved in the Battle of Canary Wharf.
Yes.
Where her niece was killed.
Could be.
Yep, that's a really good point.
I think he just whispers something in there that...
Something rude.
Yeah, that's right. No, I think it's just something that Stephen Greenhorn didn't want to write. It's just, I don't know, something. Whisper, whisper. But it does mean that we get the Doctor's face slapped, which is quite good. And it is a bit more satisfying when it's David Tennant than when it's Christopher Eccleston, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like Tennant's sort of resigned reaction is actually better than Eccleston whinging about it. My face hurts.
And with the mothers, always the mothers. What do we think of Freema in this and how Martha's developed?
We've expressed reservations already about just this whole plot and how kind of horrible the Doctor seems to her. And you know, he's kind of showboating and stuff for the first and second episodes of the trip. Mm. And then she kind of makes him sit down and talk to her properly. And that's kind of the first time that he expresses any concern for her. And I think that, you know, they kind of put that on hold, I think, for the Dalek two-parter a bit. They decide they're not really going to deal with that here because there's lots of, you know, squid heads and zombies and stuff to worry about. So we come sort of back to it, and I think that that scene's really kind of awkward. And I think the Doctor's super unlikable in it, like at the very beginning.
Yeah. I mean, something I got out of it watching it again this time was when she's saying, in the title saying, where are we, where are we? It is obvious that he is talking about home.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No place like it. And I just kind of look at it going, Martha, why are you so surprised? But I realize she could interpret it as he is taking me to his home because she's asked for that already.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said why that would be deeply personal and deeply painful to him. But then they have this adventure with the Daleks, who are old enemies of his, and it kind of ends with her saying, oh, you know, yeah, one got away, but, you know, whatever, and it, trying to perk him up. So immediately afterwards, oh, we've gone to his home, and then steps yeah. out, and oh, and now he's leaving me. And Tennant plays this scene like he just wants to say to her, get in and let's go to the Eye of Orion or whatever. You know, you're my mate, let's have fun. But he's still wounded, and oh no, I can't get attached again.
He is nice to her at the end. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, it looked for a second like he was just kind of going to dump her, but he really does express some warmth and gratitude and things towards her. Mm. And so had he left, like, she would have been disappointed and crushed, but he wasn't kind of dismissive of her.
No,
or anything.
No. And, you know, he acknowledged how important she's been. And
look, I just think it's she's just embarrassed because she's left the knickers drying on the clothes when they get home, and it makes it hugely awkward. I love the way it's been done. I mean, to repeat everything that had been done with Rose obviously would have been wrong, but this is, you know, this is him on the rebound, and she, and I think even earlier in the season she references that.
Yeah,
and she's pretty much the Doctor's kind of therapist. You know, when you fancy someone and they're perhaps in the friend zone and you're just, you know, and they're going through a breakup and you're like, I'm here, you become their therapist, and it's like, I don't want to be their therapist anymore, it's just too draining. And so there's a bit of relief perhaps from that, where she's like saying, look, if we're going to do this again, I'm in, and you've got to make sure I'm in properly.
Yeah.
And I can't really gauge whether or not he really thinks that, or he's just like, oh, okay, I've got nothing better to do. But I just like the way it's different, and I like the way at the end she self-selects out, and she gets to come back in a brilliant, brilliant way. It's a companion that's treated with a ton of thought and respect, and isn't like, you know, horribly murdered, then brought back to life at the end, and then comes back in a dream sequence and whatever.
I think
they do it really well. And Freema's just spectacular. I've always had just such a soft spot for her. She's a terrific actor in lots and lots of things, and her career is really taking off now.
Yeah,
I can't believe she's 40 and looks the same. She's just doing brilliantly. And so, you know, even though I would have liked to have seen more of her, and I would love her to come back somehow, it would be, you know, they've done it the right way.
I think there's a real difficulty with, you know, the way that they portrayed the Doctor's relationship with Rose. They have to be careful not to have him just sort of, and here's the next one. And so taking about half a season to kind of circle around that before she actually boards. And the Doctor is very nice. That final line, you know, as they're getting into the TARDIS at the end of the episode, where he says, oh, well, you were never really a passenger anyway. Mm. And then over the next couple of weeks, you know, we'll get the phone, we'll get the TARDIS key. They very definitely just say, nope, she's here, she's the companion from here on in. And so I think you're probably right. I can't see how else they could have reasonably done it without making the Doctor seem super callous. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a gradual thing, and I think it contributes slightly to some of the negative reputation of the character, in that because of all that, we don't get to deal with the crush on the Doctor until towards the end of the season.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. But for her part, I don't think Freema sets a foot wrong in her performance. And there's one particular thing she does that I love. And I've mentioned before that, unlike Billy Piper, who has a hugely expressive face, Freema's a lot more reserved in the facial expressions, but everything goes into the voice. Mm. You know, her voice is incredibly variegated, but the one facial expression she has, which I adore, is when she sees something that surprises her and her eyes just seem to double in size. So this episode, it's when she sees Lady Thor's desiccated foot sitting out behind the desk. In Smith and Jones, it's when the Jadoon has given her the compensation paperwork. I may put a mega cut together of this on Twitter to go out with this episode. Just all the time she's done. Because I'm pretty sure she gets to do it like once per episode. And she sort of one eyebrow goes up, the eyes flare, sort of one corner of the mouth goes up and just like a, huh?
You should see if she does it in Sense8 and New Amsterdam as well and then put that into the super edit.
Well, I've seen the first episode of Sense8 and I'll tell you what, there's a couple of things I don't think my mother would appreciate me putting up on Twitter, to be honest. But I have to say, that her second scene in Sense8 is a hell of an entrance.
It's good.
I think any problems with Martha as a character are down to the pacing of the arc rather than her performance or even David's performance. Like,
he's good in this.
Yeah. Well, sorry, when I say even David's performance, I mean their sort of rapport together. Because, look, I'm sure all of our listeners have heard rumours about perhaps Freema and David didn't get on so well, but I can see no evidence of that, even in behind-the-scenes stuff.
I had not heard that.
I mean, these are just things I've heard online and through grapevines and whatnot. And if that is the case, they are two of the most professional actors I have ever seen because there is a genuine warmth between them. And of course, you know, Martha has her crush, her affection for the Doctor. But Tennant brilliantly plays that he likes this person but doesn't want to get in. Yeah. Okay, come on, come on, Adventure Time. I'd like to have a word about tropes in this episode.
Really?
Yes.
For want of a better word.
For want of a better word. So Simon's not here to hear me. So at 8 minutes 30,
yep,
we have an unspecified overload klaxon, is what I've written here.
Right.
Because the machine goes wrong and the Doctor just shouts, "It's overloading!"
I absolutely adore that scene, it's can brilliant. I say? Yeah. It's so good. All of those people sort of standing around in sort of lovely suits with canapes and things, and they're sort of... I mean, let's talk about the fact that we have our mad scientist episode. There's no aliens here apart from Mr. Saxon.
Yeah. Russell's four-word brief to Stephen Greenhorn, who thought he was being called in for an interview, right? But he was called in and Russell basically said, "You're writing us a script. Mad scientist Bonday, go."
It's so good. And just the scale of it seems to be perfectly right. Maybe I've said that before this episode, but there seems to be just the right amount of material for a 45-minute episode.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
It's very simple. I mean, it's very straightforward. There's no twists or anything like that. It is just the monster rampages. I guess the only twist, which is beautifully lampshaded, is Lazarus surviving and reviving in the ambulance and killing the two ambulance people.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor says that he should have realized that someone called Lazarus was going to rise from the dead, which is just awesome.
Yeah.
Doctor Who and the Mass giveaway, yeah.
Fendelman.
Lazarus, yeah.
Tony Dalek agent.
It's really, like, I think that that's really good, and the scale of it is great, that it's just happening in two buildings in Southwark, not very far away from one another, and the two locations are both really great, I think.
Yes, yeah, it looks wonderful. In terms of scale, however, I would like to point out that several of the monitors that are displaying the sort of rotating Lazarus symbol or whatever it is, are completely the wrong aspect ratio. It's meant to be a circle,
Oh, I hate those people who can't get their anamorphic ratios right. They don't deserve televisions.
There seems to be a Windows start bar at the bottom of some of the screens.
Oh. Have you guys seen Prometheus, like a $100 million movie? And on the spaceship, it has a Windows taskbar in the year 2200 or something as well. It proves that Microsoft is here forever, guys.
I see you are being impregnated by an alien. Would you like to restart?
That symbol, there's a scene where all these sort of panicky silhouettes of partygoers are running past a sort of symbol on the wall. That symbol's the symbol on the Master's ring.
Yes, because he ends up using Lazarus's research. And he's done what the Silence do in that he has co-opted Lazarus's research.
So there is a little bit of dialogue in The Sound of Drums, isn't there, that sort of justifies why he was behind the Lazarus experiment.
Yeah, yeah. And the nice thing is it's never kind of referred to in dialogue. Oh, yes, I recognize that symbol. That was on the wall in this technological advancement and research institute.
Yeah.
Gareth, isn't it? And then we have an attempted trope with shoving the Doctor and Martha into the cabinet of Dr. Lazarus. And that to me feels like something that's meant to be sort of screwball comedy and funny, and it's just mostly very unfunny except for one line from Freeba, that line of, well, in your own time.
Oh, isn't there something where he has to kind of lower himself
Yes.
to the ground?
Yeah, and that was should carry-on be funny.
yeah, that's it. That's sort of while you're down there moment.
I interpreted it as carry on.
I mean, the thing is, it's carry on, but it's carry on England. It's not carry on spying. It's not even carry on Columbus.
I love the way we've got to attempted tropes now.
There is some pretty ropey kind of rooftop shots.
Yes, and I figured out what it was this time. The motion of the camera and the motion of the CG mat of the skyline don't quite match up.
I think it's much worse than that.
Really?
I mean, it just doesn't convince for a second.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no, it's super terrible. It's sort of underworld level terrible. And we did comment on it a little bit in the Daleks in Manhattan
episodes. Terrible stuff.
But you know, those were ambitious, I think, and the episode would have been much, much poorer without them. Here, though, it's, you know, the BBC unable to produce a sort of convincing scene of people standing on a rooftop.
Which is bizarre when you've got a pretty decent 20-foot-long scorpion.
Well, pretty decent.
Pretty decent.
They've never beaten The Greatest Show in the Galaxy for the matte shot, I don't think.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
True.
The thing that also gets me about this sort of technically is the music and the mixing. I just find it so in your face now compared to the new season 11, where it's so undertoned and so background and so atmospheric. This is just blurting stuff at you all the time. And I honestly found it quite hard to hear sometimes. So that's another technical thing that doesn't quite work, along with the monster's face and along with the skylines. It could have just been, lots of things could be slightly toned down to make it click.
There is one massive loud music cue that I actually really like, where we're focusing on Martha's reaction to the Doctor leaving for the first time before the opening credits.
Yeah,
I think that's wonderful.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, and there's one music moment which I found really cute at the time, but this afternoon when I was rewatching the episode made me laugh and say, really? And that's when the Doctor and Martha come out of the lift and the string quartet at the party are playing Martha's theme.
I actually really liked that.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that. I saw them looking quite grumpy while they were doing it. And I was just like, this string quartet does not want to be here.
Well, but yeah, the thing is, there's a missing scene where Professor Lazarus has tried to sleaze onto all of them.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
That's almost certainly what happened.
And the thing is, they're actually really rude and they deserve to die because they're anti-ginger. And that's the real message of this episode. Be nice to gingers or they will drain your life essence.
Yeah.
listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to find out what happens when that nerdy kid from Points of View gets access to Michelle Collins and a reasonable CGI budget. We'll see you then for 42. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find our Series 11 Flashcast, Jodie into Terror, at jodieintoterror.com and at jodieintoterror on Twitter, and our James Bond commentary podcast, Bondfinger, at bondfinger.com, at Bondfinger on Facebook, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next time, may you remember to eat a square meal before your next Botox session. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Broadley, Brendan Jones and Colin Neal. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Some Custard Pies and a Few Harsh Words, was recorded on the 25th of August 2019 and released on the 20th of October. An even more terrifying product launch than the Lazarus experiment was, of course, the launch of the original iPhone, during which Steve Jobs unhinged his entire jaw and ate three lead programmers and a terrified David Pogue.
There we go.
Okay, what do we need to do? That might be it.
This can go on the tag, but everyone needs a shave.
Oh, really?
Like, just everyone has a 5 o'clock shadow. And the only reason I can think of it is, like, pretty much everything was shot at, like, 3 a.m. But, yeah, Tennant needs a shave. Gatiss needs a shave. The only person who doesn't need a shave is Reggie Yates. The only guy who doesn't need a shave is Reggie
Yates.
He's
very young, though.
He's very young and very pretty. Did I mention he's pretty?
Oh, you might have.
He's very pretty.
All right. Well, I think that might be it. What do you think?
Yeah.
God, the Scorpion King thing is so shit, isn't it? Like,
as in the movie The Scorpion King. Yeah, it's really bad, and it's the denouement of the movie.
There was a video, there was a YouTube channel, you know, where some effects guys analyze CG effects in movies, and they actually set themselves the task of making that better. Uh-huh. And they get some proper footage of Dwayne Johnson from somewhere, and they, you know, put some flames in and stuff, and they actually make it really good in sort of like 12 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, technology's advanced.
I mean, there's the land eel from Star Trek Voyager in 1996, I want to say, looks better than the Scorpion King.
Wait, the land eel from Threshold?
No, from Basics.
Oh, yeah, okay. God,
nothing from Threshold looks good before 1996.
So bad.
It's like, let's not address the fact that Tom abducted the captain.
And has sex with her, and they have babies.
Against, you know, has sex with her while she's unconscious and transformed into another species, and they have babies, which are then left behind.
So gross.
At this point, I'm contractually obliged to ask on behalf of James, when are we doing the Voyager podcast?
And I'm contractually obliged, as Richard is not here, to say tag.
Brilliant. I reckon that's a tag. Awesome.